With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Emma Taylor.
I'm Joanna Shanks.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
So Emma, tell me what you've been up to. What's your chat?
I have been taking part in the jury, the murder trial live event. I think so. We've both been doing this. Have you watched the second one yet?
No, I've watched the first one and looked at the evidence, but I haven't looked at the second one yet.
Yeah, I'm torn. I am enjoying it, but I think that part of the problem I'm having with it is that just to explain for anyone who's not aware of what this is, the Murder Trial Live usually go and do live shows, maybe a couple of hours long. I think you can even do the ones where you like get your dinner and stuff with it, and then they do a show which is essentially a trial, and the audience decide and get to vote whether the person's guilty or innocent, and they're based on true stories and true evidence. So it's really for true crime buffs, essentially. But because of lockdown and COVID, what they're doing is they're doing it online streaming, and you pay to be part of the jury. They're calling it like a social experiment for the nation. And I believe 30 odd thousand people are involved. Yeah, so it's in six parts, and they're doing it two episodes a week for 3 weeks. And then you have the final live show and you vote. I'm finding it a bit slow for me. I'm not enjoying it at all. I just think that it's partly aimed at people who probably don't have the same level of understanding of some of the, you know, the way that things are done in the court system. I think some of it is very kind of introductory level, which is absolutely fine because there will definitely be people out there that need that. But I think because we read and watch so much to do with true crime, I was a bit like, yep, already know this. Yep, already know that. Okay, cool. Can we get to the evidence already?
I completely agree. I watched the first episode and then I thought I might wait until there's a few episodes that I can watch back to back, because like you, it's a bit slow paced for me. That's just preference. You know, people will probably be doing it with families, young kids and stuff. So I get it. But yeah, for me personally, it's a little bit slow paced too.
I think it's really beautifully produced, actually. And I think the actors are really good that are in it. But I think I'd probably rather go to one of the live shows, and the ones that they do that you can have your dinner and a drink and stuff like that and just have a bit of fun. You're not like a murder mystery, but you know, that kind of idea. I would love that more.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love all that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, like sitting having your dinner, actors, the story, all that kind of stuff. There's more of an atmosphere, isn't there? Whereas when you're just sitting at home and you're watching a thing online and then just looking at some evidence, you know, if you're doing it on your own, you don't have that ambiance, do you? It's not the same.
Absolutely. But I'm glad I did it. I'm going to see it through to the end, definitely. We are both enjoying it, although I did notice Richard playing on his phone, so maybe he's not that interested. But I do think that it will be interesting to see if they let us know what the outcomes of the cases were that it was based on. Not that it should really matter, because there was an amalgamation of cases, so I don't really know how that affects things, but yeah, that'll be interesting to see. And apart from that, I know that we've both become a little bit obsessed with leggings recently.
Funky fit.
Funky fit leggings. Sorry, my fault. You're obsessed now.
There's something else though, because I think you kind of need to have a range of them, don't you? You need to have your kind of active wear leggings. You need to have your cozy ones that you want to just relax in the house. You want sort of thick, comfy ones. Then you want your more lightweight ones. So it's easy to have quite a big collection of leggings. But I typically always go, because I've never seen any that are particularly patterned or colourful or interesting, I typically go for quite plain colours, and I'll just pair them with like, you know, a colourful t-shirt or whatever as now. But I love the colours, the patterns. And when I received my first pair yesterday, I was so surprised at how soft and comfortable they were. Like, I did not expect that at all. And yeah, just the deep waistband, which is an absolute must for me. I don't do the tiny little waistbands that dig in. Yeah, as I say, I've already ordered a pair of the leopard print shorts because they just look insane. And I'll be ordering many, many more because there are so many patterns that I want.
Yep, I love them. I've got 5 pairs. One of them is the capris and the rest of the full length. I'm only 5'2", so they are a bit long on me, but I just kind of turn them up like inside the wave, you know what I mean? And they're absolutely fine. But yeah, it's still quite a small company, I think. They're based in England. The owners are on there chatting away to people day in, day out, and they just pick some really amazing different fabrics and patterns that make you feel really cheery when you put them on. I think if you are either working from home or doing exercise or even relaxing and you look down at your legs and they look fun, there's just something enjoyable about that. So yeah, they're called Funky Fit. You can find them on Facebook and you find them on Instagram, Funky Fit 2019, I think it is. Just if anyone's interested. We're not sponsored or anything, we just love them.
Absolutely. I mean, I wore my new pair out for a run this morning, just taking up running again this week. As you know, my mental health hadn't been great at all and didn't really know what was going on. And this week I started running again. And I always forget how good it makes me feel. You know, I get that buzz after I exercise. And I think I need to focus more on how I feel after the fact, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, the process. But yeah, we've got a beautiful park near us, but because it's such a drab day, I wore my lovely colourful leggings and yeah, it made me feel nice and cheery. And now I feel great. It does set me up for the day. You know, I've been going in the morning and I think that's it. I think I need to keep up the physical exercise because it just does wonders for my mental health.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. And I know some of my friends are the same. Just if you have to go off it for doing anything, if you're not well or whatever it is, you do notice it. You just feel a bit flat and it's hard to push yourself though. I find it really hard, you know, if I'm struggling with the energy, if I'm struggling with feeling rubbish anyway, to push yourself to go and exert that energy it's not there. You don't feel like you've got it in the tank. And then once you've done it, you feel more energetic. It's a weird one. It's such an irritating kind of catch-22. You've basically just got to force yourself to do it and then reap the benefits afterwards.
Because we've got such a nice park, it's quite good because if I'm too tired to run or if I've got strain or whatever, then I can have a nice walk around the park. So,
and we're training so that if a serial killer chases us, we can run away.
Yeah, absolutely. Because thick thighs might save lives, but fast runners will outrun killers.
Exactly. I'm sure they don't practice that. They probably practice like binding your wrists and, you know, how they're going to chop you up. But I bet they don't practice running.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Do you want to hear about my case?
I'd love to hear about your case.
Right. So I wanted to go a little bit different this week because I know that we've obviously covered a lot of cases so far. And, you know, we've done a lot of women and, you know, very, very sort of recent or in the past sort of 30 years or so. So I kind of wanted to go a little bit different. So I've got a little bit. I've gone a little bit different this week.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
So this week I am doing the case of Edward William Pritchard. also known as the human crocodile or the poisoning philanderer.
Wow. Those are some nicknames.
Have you heard of him before?
No, I would definitely remember those names.
It starts off in England, but he does end up in Scotland, so I'm not going rogue here. So Edward William Pritchard, he was born in Hampshire in 1825, and he was from a naval family. His father was a captain. He claimed to have studied at King's College London, but his medical qualifications were questionable and a little bit vague. He was known to have been an apprentice under physicians in Portsmouth at age 15, and then he went on to do some studying in London. So I think that's where he's introduced that he studied at King's College London, but that seems to be in question. He served as an assistant surgeon with the Royal Navy for some time, serving on the HMS Victory and some other ships for several years. I think it was about 6 years. And then when he was on leave in Portsmouth in 1850, he met his future wife, Mary Jane Taylor, which is similar to your name, which I thought was a cute coincidence.
Oh, that is cute.
So yeah, he met his future wife in Portsmouth in 1850 while on leave from the Navy. Mary was the daughter of a prominent silk merchant in Edinburgh. So he left the Navy and they moved to a small village in Yorkshire, and he became a GP and he joined the Masonic Lodge. But apparently he despised life as a country doctor and was known to be a bit of a character. I think he kind of told a lot of stories and made a lot of claims. Apparently he walked with a cane that had been inscribed from Garibaldi, which people didn't believe was actually genuine. So probably full of a few tall tales, if you know what I mean. But he did have a noticeable presence. So it sounds like he was kind of one of those people that once he entered the room, you couldn't ignore him. So indications are that they left Yorkshire to move to Glasgow. But when they left Yorkshire, they were under a cloud of suspicion, with some rumours flying around in regards to him being involved with his female patients and some questions around his finances. He was known to borrow money from Mary's family, and it was purported that he was in debt. So kind of just a bit of talk, you know, a few rumours and stuff. Nothing solid at that time, but certainly that was the vibe anyway. So Mary and Edward had 5 children, and when they left Yorkshire, they moved to Glasgow. They originally stayed in Edinburgh with Mary's parents, who lived at 1 Lauder Road in the Grange. I don't know if you know where that is. Like, I know exactly where Lauder Road is.
Roughly, yeah.
Yeah, because I have a friend who used to live in Cosbyside, so I used to drive through there all the time. But beautiful houses, absolutely beautiful houses.
Probably massive as well.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely massive. That area is just gorgeous. But, you know, if he was a prominent silk merchant, then that's understandable.
What a job. That would be an amazing job.
Yeah. So they stayed in Edinburgh with her parents at Lauder Road in the Grange before they moved to a new home in Glasgow. So it sounds like they moved to a few houses in and around sort of Socky Hall Street and Blythewood Square. I think they maybe had different names at that time, but they lived in a few houses around that time. It sounds like they were getting a house built or renovated. So it sounds like they kind of dotted about a bit until that was ready. I don't know if I actually mentioned, Mary's parents helped pay for their house in Glasgow that they were moving to. So they lived at a house in Barclay Terrace, which I don't think is there anymore. I think it's been renamed or rejigged. So it was a house called Barclay Terrace, which was sort of in and around Socky Hall Street. And the house had an attic space for 2 maids. There'd long been rumours that Edward Pritchard had also been involved with female staff. And it was rumoured that he had impregnated one of the young maids.
Do we know if this was consensual or not?
No.
Okay.
Don't know. So in 1863, a fire broke out in the maid's bedroom in the attic of Barclay Terrace. So the Barclay Terrace house. The other maid that shared the room, she wasn't home, and neither was Mary Pritchard. Now, after the flames were doused and the maid's body was discovered, it appeared that she hadn't made any attempt to escape the room. This led to questions surrounding whether she'd been drugged or unconscious at the time the fire started, or perhaps already dead. Despite the suspicion and the Procurator Fiscal looking into the case, no charges were brought, and Edward Pritchard successfully claimed on an insurance policy for the fire. Very suspicious. They did look into it, but no charges were brought. After the fire, they obviously moved to a new residence in Royal Crescent because obviously one of the maids had passed away. They hired a new maid who was a 15-year-old girl by the name of Mary McLeod. Mary had confided to a fellow maid that she was having an affair with Edward Pritchard. She apparently stated that Edward had promised she would take his wife's place if anything ever happened to her. And it's believed that Edward carried out an abortion on this young girl after impregnating her. It's believed that Mary Pritchard and her mother, Jane Taylor, knew about the affair with Mary McLeod. And it's also suggested that Mary Pritchard may have caught her husband kissing the young maid.
So the maid and the wife were both called Mary?
Yes.
I thought we had a thing about Marys that you weren't allowed to pick any more Marys.
Well, the case is about a man named Edward.
I didn't just know thought you'd slide that one by me there.
I didn't know there were going to be some Marys in here. But yeah, so Mary McLeod was the 15-year-old maid. Mary Pritchard was the wife.
Okay, great.
So it's suggested that Mary Pritchard, the wife, may have caught her husband kissing the young maid. And articles suggest that his in-laws, or at least his mother-in-law, idolised their son-in-law. So I don't know if they just sort of brushed over it and was like, oh, you know, boys will be boys, or, you know, some nonsense like that. And there was no real fuss about it. I don't know. It doesn't seem to give any indication. But there was mention that Mary's parents idolised their son-in-law. So in late 1864, Mary Pritchard became ill. She suffered dizziness and sickness, and she went to spend some time with her parents in Edinburgh. Mary's health improved, so she returned to Glasgow to spend Christmas with her family, but her health began to deteriorate again. Several doctors were consulted, but none of them diagnosed the problem until a local resident was called in, a neighbour by the name of Dr. James Patterson. Exact same spelling as the author, by the way. He suspected that Mary was being poisoned and recommended she go into hospital. But I think as a compromise, her mother came to stay with her instead to look after her in February 1865. However, shortly after she arrived, Mary's mother also became ill. Mary's mother, Jane, was taking large quantities of Batley's sedative solution, which was actually opium. Because, you know, back in those days,
opium, everything was legal.
Everything was legal. Yeah, opium was taken willy-nilly and nobody thought anything of it. So yeah, she was taking large quantities of this stuff.
Just on a side note, have you ever seen, there's a bottle of medicine that there's a picture of it circulating around the internet, and it's like relaxation and digestive aid, and it's got like opium, cocaine, alcohol, it's got like all these things, and then it's like, yeah, you would feel better.
Really? What, from way back when?
Yeah, I'll need to find it and send you it, but yeah, that'll do the trick, I'd imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So her mother was taking large quantities of the stuff, and it was actually proved in court that Edward had poisoned her supply. There are accounts of Mary becoming unwell after Edward had come into contact with food that had been prepared for her. And sometimes it was actually brought up to her by the young maid, Mary McLeod. There were some accusations made that Mary McLeod had been involved with poisoning Edward's wife. So around 2 weeks after Mary's mother came to look after her, she died. And Mary followed suit around a month later in March 1865.
Very suspicious, especially mm-hmm. if nobody else in the household's gotten ill, if it's supposedly exactly. contagious.
Exactly. And there was mentioned that apparently Mary's mum said, oh, I basically must have caught what Mary has, without actually realising how accurate she was. But it was something she caught. It was the same ailment, but because it was actually being administered to them.
That's awful.
So, it is. It is awful. So Mary's mother died in February 1865, and then Mary herself died in March 1865. That was Edward's wife. Edward Pritchard asked Dr. James Patterson to sign the death certificates. However, Dr. Patterson refused. Edward then signed the death certificates himself and attributed his mother-in-law's death to apoplexy and his wife's death to gastric fever. No post-mortem examinations were carried out on either woman.
It just shows what you can do when you're in a position of power and trusted, doesn't it?
Exactly. Now, after Mary had been prepared and placed in the coffin, Edward actually asked for the lid of his wife's coffin to be lifted before she was buried, and he wept while he placed a kiss on her lips. As a result, the nickname the human crocodile was attributed to him, as crocodiles cry as they eat their prey, which I didn't actually know.
I didn't know that. Is it to help it go down easier, or?
No idea.
How bizarre. Because I thought crocodile tears was a saying, you know, if you're faking your tears.
It is. It is. Okay. And that's where it comes from. So crocodile tears, I know, is a saying for just fake tears. It's, you know, it's just put on. But
so that's
That's why, which I
that
didn't know.
Sense.
Yeah. So he got the moniker, the human crocodile, as a result. The procurator fiscal received an anonymous letter suggesting that the deaths were suspicious. And following this, the bodies were exhumed. Postmortems were carried out and both women were found to have been poisoned. Edward Pritchard was charged and found guilty of their deaths following a five-day hearing in Edinburgh in July 1865 and sentenced to death by hanging. He was transferred to Glasgow's North Prison and the Scotsman reported that he confessed that Mary's mother knew of the quote-unquote improper intimacy between himself and the young maid. So Mary's mum, Jane Taylor, her cause of death on her death certificate was amended to read tartarized antimony, aconite and opium, or one or more of them, or other poison willfully administered by the said Edward William Pritchard in medicine, food or drink, not precisely known, but not more than 14 days. So basically poisoned her for 2 weeks.
With, what was it?
Antimony or antimony and aconite.
I wonder what those are called in today's.
But they also think it might have been an opium overdose as well. Apparently she went through like a 3 month supply in 2 weeks.
So antimony is a silver white poisonous metal. Aconite is any of various temperate plants of the ranunculaceous, that's the word, genus Aconitum, such as monk's hood and wolf's bane.
Oh yeah, I've heard of wolf's bane.
Yeah. So it's part of that family of plants. So that's strange. He did a double whammy then. He went for the metal and he went for a plant. He must have known they were both poisonous and just thought, if one of them doesn't get you, the other one will.
Yeah, strange, isn't it? Or maybe
covering your bases.
Yeah, exactly. Mary Pritchard's cause of death was subsequently amended to read from antimony and aconite, or one or other of them, or other poison, feloniously administered in food, drink and medicine by her said husband from December 1864 to date of death. So 3 months she suffered.
So they're saying it could be one or the other. I wonder if that means that they produced very similar effects on the body.
Oh yeah, maybe.
They're saying both or one or the other. It's probably more likely that they weren't entirely sure which one.
Yeah. So it appears that Edward Pritchard was never charged over the death of the maid who had passed away at Barclay Terrace, but he is largely suspected of having killed her, probably because he'd had an affair with her and impregnated her. The defence tried to accuse Mary MacLeod of having been the perpetrator of the crime, so that was the young 15-year-old maid that he'd also impregnated and had carried out an abortion on. However, shortly before his death, Edward Pritchard confessed to having been responsible for both of the murders. Edward Pritchard was hanged 3 weeks after his conviction in July 1865. The hanging took place in the Salt Market end of Glasgow Green, also known as Jail Square, which is now known as Jocelyn Square, and the McLennan Arch now stands where the public hangings took place, opposite the High Court. An article from the Glasgow Times states, "The area is called Jocelyn Square, and if you check the flagstones in front of the impressive McLennan Arch, you will see one that commemorates the area's gruesome history." An inscription reads, "Jocelyn Gate. This area, formerly known as Jocelyn Square, was the site of both the famous Glasgow Fair and, until 1865, of public executions. The first executions at the spot were in 1814, and over the years, 67 men and 4 women were hanged there. due to the nature of his crimes, he wasn't actually afforded the privacy usually given to prisoners sentenced to hang immediately before death, so he was publicly hanged. A crowd of more than 100,000 people attended to watch him hang, and he was the last person to be publicly hanged in Scotland.
Oh my goodness. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
So there you go. So a little bit of history for you there. And I've seen the MacLennan Arch in Glasgow, but I didn't know its relevance.
Absolutely.
And I didn't know that that's where they used to do the public hangings. A few little unusual tidbits I found, which I thought might be interesting. Edward William Pritchard was found to have purchased his doctorate from a university in Germany. So he didn't actually have a PhD. So he wasn't a doctor.
At all.
No. He apparently attempted to join societies and clubs for the learned when he arrived in Glasgow, but he was unsuccessful.
Because he wasn't clever enough, presumably.
I reckon that people just probably knew he was a fraud. You know, I think his reputation probably preceded him. Because, you know, there was a lot of mention of the sort of questionable education and history. And I think if you, you know, if you studied somewhere in London, you would expect to probably have connections or know some people or some people to know you. You know, I think it's probably very easy to sort of disprove this kind of thing. So it sounds like a lot of people were very dubious of his claims anyway. So, yeah, he was found to have purchased the doctorate from a university in Germany, and he was snubbed from the sort of societies for the learned in Glasgow. And he had joined the Masonic Lodge in Yorkshire after he was charged and hanged. They actually had his name removed from the plaque of the Masonic Lodge.
You know you're a bad guy if even the Freemasons don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that
wow.
That is the case of the fake doctor, because he wasn't a real doctor, Edward William Pritchard, aka the human crocodile or the poisoning philanderer.
Gosh, that is some life to have led.
Did you enjoy that?
I enjoyed it. I think, you know what, it reminds me of these cases. So obviously back in the day, it would be a little bit easier to fake your credentials, I would imagine.
Yeah, for sure.
Or purchase them, that kind of thing, because there wouldn't be the same sharing of information available across countries and across different institutions and things like that. What gets me is when people manage it in today's day and age. I find that fascinating. You know, every few years, mostly in America, you'll hear of someone who's been practicing as a doctor or as, you know, some other high level professional. And they've just completely made it up. They've just faked it all. And I'm absolutely amazed because I just don't know how they get away with it. You know, the balls on these people to be able to continue living their life like that.
Absolutely. I mean, Frank Abagnale Jr. is a perfect example of that.
Just in case anyone doesn't know, you want to go into the details of
yeah,
Frank.
Yeah, Frank Abagnale Jr., although fair enough, I think it was in the 60s. The 50s or the 60s? I think it was the 60s. And yeah, the film Catch Me If You Can is all about him. It was the fake it till you make it kind of thing. He forged checks. He posed as an airline pilot. He did loads. He pretended that he was a lawyer, but then he actually sat the bar exam and passed the bar exam. Yeah, he was the sort of the ultimate con man. And then after he was eventually tracked down and charged, he was eventually offered a job with the FBI to help them determine sort of check forgery. And then he became like the sort of leading expert on it. And he worked for the FBI for the next 30 years or something, I think. But yeah, it was bizarre. You know, you just think, how can somebody get away with all that? And you know, it's crazy. Not even that, like, maybe this is obviously just me being completely naive, but even when I hear people like, you know, in news reports when they say, you know, and they traveled on a fake passport, I'm like, how did you get passed on a fake passport? I mean, surely if you've bought a fake passport, they've all got like chips and stuff in them these days.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did you?
I know they must be so advanced now.
Yeah. That's the thing that baffles me. I'm like, how do people flee the country on a fake passport? You know, that just that.
I'd be trying to swim away or something, thinking I'm not going to get away with that.
I'd be like jumping on ferries and absolutely.
Yeah, so from watching the Jeffrey Epstein documentary, he taught as a teacher with no credentials. And then he was hired into the stock market with no credentials. And then when they found out he lied, he still got more jobs. And people were like, oh, well, but he's really good, so it doesn't really matter. No, that's not how that works.
That's right. That's right. Because I haven't finished watching that documentary yet, but I think I watched the first few episodes and I think I just felt a bit sickened by him. Mm. So I think I might have just stopped watching it for that reason. But yeah, I remember the guy talking about, there was one guy, though, that worked for the investment house or whatever it was, and he said he didn't agree with the fact that he wasn't sort of immediately chucked out when he was found to do a fraud. He just did not stand by that, and that was a big, big mistake, because he ultimately went on to continue on. But it's even things like, it might sound silly, but I'm naive in the fact that I just think people that are in specific positions are really well qualified and educated. I just seem to have that perception. And then even recently I was watching another documentary that you recommended, Dirty Money.
Yep.
Which I really enjoyed. I've watched a few of them now, and I've enjoyed every episode. Side note, the one about HSBC was very interesting. Really interesting. I liked that. But I watched one about Donald Trump, and I didn't actually know that he came from like a real estate. His family were just really successful in like real estate and stuff. And actually the documentary was saying things like,
he's declared bankruptcy multiple times. A lot of people don't know about.
It was something about he went bankrupt like 5 times and couldn't get money from lenders because of his terrible credit history, and he made really bad decisions. And also one of the things that I didn't know is that he licenses out his name. So they were saying things like, now, if I went to New York and I saw his name on, I think it was either 17 or 19 buildings, if I saw his name on those buildings, I would assume that he owned them.
Yeah.
And what it was saying is that actually, out of those 17 or 19 buildings that his name was on, he only actually owns 5 of them outright. He just licenses out his name because it's almost a brand that he's created. And it was saying that he's made a fortune from doing the same in places like Shanghai as well, because he's just put his name on new developments and things.
People buy into it, don't
they? People buy into it. But actually, you know, I didn't know that he'd opened a casino in Atlantic City that just absolutely tanked. And he spent an absolute fortune. He could not afford to build it. Then it completely plummeted.
Which is ironic, seeing that casinos are one of the best money-making enterprises in the world.
I mean, Sean said that to me. He's like, how? How can a casino fail? Like, you must be really bad if you cannot make a casino successful. And it was supposed to be this big, lavish casino that he couldn't even afford to build. You know, and it seems to be that he's bragged a lot about being very, very rich and having loads and loads of money. But the documentary I was watching was saying, you know, at times that he claimed that he was worth, say, $1 billion. And people were like, no, we actually estimated to be worth it like 20 million. And they were saying, don't get me wrong, that is a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, yeah.
But that he's claiming to be a stage above what he actually is. And a lot of it is just spin. And I think he creates a lot of his own PR spin and kind of always has as well. Mm-hmm. So actually that really sort of opened my eyes to, you know, his background and the kind of person that he actually is. It was really interesting. I definitely enjoyed it.
I watched another documentary with Richard, and I don't know if you like her or not, she's quite divisive, Stacey Dooley.
I don't know who that is.
She's from London, and she's got quite a strong London accent, and she does a lot of documentaries, and I find her really personable and quite friendly, but she's probably a little bit irritating to other people. But this particular one, I had never heard of it, and I don't know how I hadn't heard of it. There's been a rise since 2010 of hidden camera footage in Seoul in South Korea. So it's like a really big thing. It's been sweeping across the country. They've had to put in loads of laws. It's called MOLKA, M-O-L-K-A, and it's things from hidden cameras in toilets. They have love motels, hidden cameras in there. And the one that really got me, so this is happening across a lot of South Korea, and it's all being uploaded online. Porn is illegal there. So these are like file sharing websites that people are posting them to, but even just like filming people in public, upskirting, taking pictures up people's skirts, filming things like that. And one girl actually killed herself over it. In this documentary, what had happened was it was people working in a hospital, and it was a doctor that did this. He had the camera in the female changing rooms.
No.
Yeah, really. So it was other, I don't know if she was a doctor, she worked at the hospital, and she was filmed, and she was so humiliated that she ended up jumping from her flat. I think it was the 17th floor. They were talking to her parents. It was just horrific. And there's underground kind of movements trying to tear them down and report them to police and things like that. But I was so, so shocked. They have a really low birth rate in South Korea, and a lot of men in their 20s report that they are virgins or they haven't ever had a relationship. And it's almost like they've distanced themselves so far from women that they consume them, that they are, you know, a product and they're not a person anymore. Some of the things that they'll do, even ones like in the love motels, the videos that they shared, they were blurring out the men's faces. So this couple would go in not knowing that they were being filmed, thinking they're in an intimate moment, and the woman was freely available to be seen. It could ruin her career, it could ruin her whole life because of the cultural norms there. And yeah, they would blur the man's face, give him the protection.
That's horrendous. What did you say the documentary is called?
Stacey Dooley Investigates Spy Cam Sex Criminals.
What platform is it on?
It was on BBC.
Might need to have a look for that.
Really interesting. So that's another thing that people might want to look at. But yeah, just what you're saying, I think that we do have a propensity to assume people's morals just because they're in a certain position, and assume that they're doing the best job or just... So it reminds me, there's something that we learned about in my psychology degree. I can't remember the name of it at the minute. I'm sure someone will fill us in. But it's essentially the method where we go around making assumptions about other people and about situations, shortcuts that our brain gives us, you know, so that we don't have to automatically assess every single situation that we come into. If you see a police officer, depending on who you are, you should be able to assume certain things about them. If you go on a bus and you've been on a bus before, you know, your brain understands that you should be able to assume certain things about that situation, because otherwise every single interaction that we have would be a brand new interaction and be really time consuming and really difficult for you to process every single time. And it's very much that same kind of thing when someone's given a title, especially if it's an accredited position, an accredited organization or position that someone's in, you kind of give them these other characteristics as well that they may not necessarily have. It's time saving, essentially.
Ego brain.
Absolutely. But it can lead to so many failures because those assumptions are not always correct. It's actually another thing that was really interesting that we learned in my degree was that people automatically assume that good looking people are good, that they're good people. And perhaps you don't specifically, but you're more likely, as a human being, we are more likely to attribute good characteristics or positive characteristics to people who are categorically or, you know, classically good looking. It's a bit like, who would you trust to hold your stuff? Who would you trust to ask for change of pound or whatever?
Interesting.
You would be more likely to trust the person that was, you know, relatively attractive than someone who is perhaps not. There's no reason that you should really feel that way. You see the cases of men that end up in prison and have women throwing themselves at them. I'm also fascinated by that.
Yeah, I find that really, the whole Ted Bundy thing, the whole fascination with him, just because he was, well, I assume it's just because people believed he was good looking. You're right, that baffles me.
I think that's one of the things that I will always struggle to get my head around. You know, you do get people who are on their kind of bandwagon of, oh no, he didn't do it, I understand him more than anyone else does. Fair enough, if you want to throw your life away and go down that track, do that. But I just don't get it.
So do you have a little true crime tidbit for us this week?
I do. Once again, it's actually written really nicely, so I'm going to read it verbatim. It's on Murdoch University's website, which seems to be in Australia, but it actually is related to Christian Bala, who's a Polish author. Bala wrote a crime novel in 2003, which quickly became a bestseller in Poland. It gripped the nation and received a lot of publicity. However, Police found many of the details about the murder in the novel really familiar. The description of the murder was remarkably similar to what they knew about an unsolved case on their books, the torture and murder of Darius Januszewski. Police decided to dig a bit deeper and discovered not only had Christian known the victim, he was the last person to have seen him alive and actually sold Januszewski's mobile phone. And subsequently, they charged him. He received 25 years in prison because he wrote a book about it.
Holy shit, so he murdered someone, nobody knew it was him, he wrote a book about it, and that's how he ended up getting caught.
A best-selling book.
Holy shit!
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, but also, what a fucking idiot.
I know, I mean, how stupid. Because he must have put in details that only he could have known. And what arrogant, like, how arrogant do you need to be to do
but
that?
But that's par for the course, though, isn't it, generally with murderers, is that they are sociopaths, arrogant, egotistical, that's... They're better than everybody else, cleverer than everybody else.
Unfortunately, he did it in a way that could get him found out, unlike the Zodiac, who was like, haha, still not caught me, except that we know that it's Ted Cruz. But,
see ya, bitches. Yeah, definitely.
Isn't that totally bizarre?
Really bizarre, yeah, absolutely.
Can you imagine, you're like reading the book, you're a police officer, and you're like, oh God, these just keep running into one. I could have sworn I read something like this recently. And you're like, hang on, bit off just the left toenail on the pinky toe. Hang on a minute.
We didn't release that to the press.
Crudely drew a penis on the forehead. Hang on a second. How many of these can there be? Thank you so much for listening. If you have a case that you would like us to consider covering, you can always email us. Our email address is info@murdershespoke.net. We're on Facebook at Murder She Spoke Podcast. Our Twitter handle is MSS_pod and our Instagram handle is Murder She Spoke Pod. If you have enjoyed listening to us, please do rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you use. We'll see you in a week.